Mitchell Gold could be leading a well-earned life of leisure and comfort, having built a successful designer furniture business and brand, Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams. But you know, that has never been Mitchell's path. Instead, he has fearlessly spoken out in defense of the dignity and value of LGBTQ persons, and he's done so for decades. And he has done so in what is all too often the most hostile of environments for those persons, organized religion, all while living in the buckle of the American Bible Belt. As we highlight stories of respect and dignity for LGBTQ persons of faith in our special series, Whosoever You Love, it is absolutely essential that we include Mitchell Gold, his story, and his vision. And so I am delighted to welcome my dear friend, Mitchell Gold, to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's so nice to be with you again today.
Mitchell, a lot of our listeners know your story already, but there are always those people who are hearing you for the first time. And so for them, I would ask you to just briefly introduce yourself and how you became an entrepreneur and an effective activist.
Well, I was born in 1951, so that makes me 67. It makes me a child of the 60s. And while there was a real expression of freedom, of newfound freedom in the 60s, for LGBT people, it was not necessarily so. And I grew up at a time when this American Psychiatric Association designated that, quote-unquote, homosexuality was a mental disorder. I grew up at a time when LGBT people really weren't out and feeling comfortable with themselves, but it was just starting. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was very closeted. I was very tormented. I thought that God hated me because in Sunday school, I, you know, read Leviticus. Mm-hmm. I thought that I was broken. And I spent too many nights crying myself to sleep. I spent too many nights trying to fix myself, pray that God would change me. And it wasn't until the early 70s when I went to a psychiatrist, and fortunately, he asked, you know, what was I there for? And I said, I need you to change me. And lucky for me, in 1971, he said, I can't change you. In fact, the American Psychiatric Association is getting ready to change their designation, and quote-unquote homosexuality will no longer be considered a mental disorder, but who you are. And I was so lucky to have that doctor. But it still socially created a problem for me because of my parents, my brother, my family, other family, my friends. So it was a while until I came out. But when I finally did, I like to say that I was born again, because then I really had the shackles of this mental anguish off of me. And I was living in New York City. I was around a lot of out, successful people. I worked at Bloomingdale's. There were a lot of incredibly brilliant, creative, high-level people that happened to be gay. Mm-hmm. So that's really when I started to live my life and started to flourish as a human being. And fortunately for me, I had a good career path. I was successful. I found the right niche for me. I loved retailing. I loved being at Bloomingdale's. I left Bloomingdale's and worked for a variety of furniture companies. And then I started a business with Bob Williams, who we fell in love with each other and decided we wanted to own a business together. We started that, and in the 90s, moved down south, had a company, and that's when President Clinton proclaimed that he was going to allow gays to be in the military. Mm-hmm. And as you recall, there was a real backlash to it, and the backlash was largely from clergy who were screaming that LGBT people were immoral, they were sinners, and they shouldn't be serving next to you in the foxhole or in a submarine. And it really struck me that people were talking like this because as a child of the 60s, I remember all too well Governor Wallace saying things like segregation now, segregation forever. It says it in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking my mother, did it say that in the Bible? And she said, not in our Bible. Mm-hmm. And I remember too well how people used their I will call them outdated and misguided and ill-informed religious beliefs and harmful religious beliefs to marginalize other people, to put themselves in a superior position. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing it again in America and in my community. And living down south gave me a very different perspective than my friends who lived in New York or Washington or L.A. And I started talking then that I think the big problem with LGBT people not having full and equal rights was people using their religious beliefs. Other people might say it's the ick factor, or they might use some other excuses, but the roots of it are in these religious beliefs that being gay, LGBT, is a sin. So I started speaking out about it, and here I am today, still speaking out about it.
So I am so glad you are here today, like you are. How were you able to come to terms with your own identity, including in what you had been hearing about religion?
By my college years, I had really put religion aside, and I was a history student, so I saw too often how wars started, how religion was used in too many wars, how religion was used too often to marginalize people, and I really moved away from any kind of religion. You know, I don't know to this day if there is a God, how I was created. I just have a personal feeling that I want to be the best that I can. I do follow the dictum in the Jewish religion, Tikkun Olam, which means that you come into this world and you're here to make it a better place. And I do feel an obligation to every day try to make it a better place. And it also gives me a great amount of joy. And I think that is a good thing when you can do good and feel good from it also. So I was away from organized religion, except that kind of living my life that way was an important thing to me. Mm-hmm. So I reconciled the religious part pretty quickly. And then I just had to reconcile the society part. And still in the 70s, even, I didn't come out at work until the late 70s.
Mitchell, you became a very effective activist. You've launched several major initiatives to help free LGBTQ people of faith from both external and self-condemnation in the name of religion. I have known you a long time, and so I know how difficult it is for you to talk about yourself and especially about your accomplishments. But I think it is incredibly important for people to hear about the change that one man can cause to happen. So would you talk about those initiatives, if you would?
Well, as a business person, I found that if I have a problem in one of my stores, I go to that store and find out what's wrong. Is it the salespeople? Is it the display? Is it the assortment of furniture? Is it the advertising? What is it that's wrong? And you get down to the root cause. And I've come to the conclusion in the whole world of trying to find absolute equality for LGBT people, legally and spiritually, that the very teaching that some religions have, that homosexuality is a sin, and I always say that in quotes because it's not the way I would really say it, but it's the way often people who hold those religious beliefs feel or think. But that is the root. That is a really toxic teaching. And when you tell a 13 or 14-year-old kid that they're a sinner, that they're broken, that they're going against God's will, that causes enormous mental anguish for a kid. And I have found that a lot of people don't want to harm young, vulnerable, innocent kids. Mm-hmm. And when they understand that those words, those teachings can cause not just mental anguish, but cause an LGBT kid to be four times more likely to take their life, to contemplate taking their life, or to suffer mental anguish than a straight kid. When a kid comes from a highly rejecting home, and what's a highly rejecting home? It's usually a home that teaches that it's a sin, mm-hmm. and that not just teaches it, but really pushes it in the pulpit on a Sunday, that pushes it at home at the dinner table. You know, those kids that feel highly rejected, they're eight times more likely than the straight, than the gay kid that's four times more likely. So it's really exponential. And I come across, I mean, right now as I sit here on the phone with you, I've got a couple of people that I've been in touch with, a young kid in Utah a young kid in my community in Taylorsville, you know, that are really suffering a lot of mental anguish because of their parents' teachings. And I've come to the conclusion that we have to get everybody talking about the sin question, and we got to get it off the list. This cannot be taught anymore.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of change. I'm so optimistic, and I know that religions can change because in my own lifetime, I've seen religions change about their teaching about interracial marriage. I've seen teachings change about women's rights. Mm-hmm. You know, recently I was at a funeral in my hometown, in my town where my factory is, and a woman passed away, and the church where the funeral was a Southern Baptist church, one that I'm sure 50 years ago was against interracial marriage. But yet here was this woman's family, two of her granddaughters married African Americans, her grandchildren were interracial, and everybody was loving and accepting in that church. And her granddaughter spoke, and her great-granddaughter spoke, who was 14 or 15 years old. And I looked at this beautiful interracial child speaking on that pulpit in the Southern Baptist Church, and just know that 50 or 70 years ago, that would not have happened.
Yeah.
So people do change. And that's what I want to, I want to take it in a really positive note. There's so many clergy that you and I know, Tony Campolo, David mm-hmm. Gushee, you know, people who used to really be against LGBT people having marriage equality and used to believe that homosexuality is a sin. They no longer believe that because they've come to understand the human suffering involved in it. Mm-hmm. That's when church doctrine changes over the course of history, when human suffering has been exposed and can no longer be acceptable.
You work for change both globally and right in your hometown. I think sometimes the latter can be more difficult. What is it like to stand up for queer kids at school board meetings and other community events, Mitchell?
Well, it's interesting. I think I am naive about some of it, but I just do it because mm-hmm. I don't think I could go to sleep at night if I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could go to sleep at night if I allowed kids in our community to just be gobbled up by, I hesitate to use the word ignorance, but it really is ignorance when people don't understand or when people don't know something. And I don't think it's mean ignorance. I think it is loving ignorance. I think there's too many people in our community who harm their own children and their neighbors' children because they just don't know. And if I can stand up and speak in a calm, logical way, I can't change everybody, but I know, and it's part of the reason I'm optimistic, that there are so many members of our community who, in fact, have changed. One member of the administration in the county called me after a school board meeting, and he said, you know, I just want you to know that when you came here close to 30 years ago and you first were open and talked about being gay and talked about equal rights, I thought you were crazy, and I didn't agree with you. But I've really come to understand that homosexuality is not a sin, and I have a young daughter, a teenager. I don't want her to think that. I don't want her to think that in case she's gay. And I don't want her to think that if she's not, because I don't want her to bully other kids who are or think that she's better than other kids. And, you know, it's those kind of conversations that I have that really give me enormous hope for the future.
What do you think it's going to take, Mitchell, for LGBTQ persons to be fully included in the life of our nation? Are you more concerned, though, right now about a backlash moving things in the opposite direction?
No, I'm not really concerned about a backlash. I think what it's going to take is it's going to take every LGBT advocacy organization to not treat the hurdle of religious beliefs, of anti-LGBT religious beliefs, as a secondary part of their mission, to not have it to be some program that's over off to the side where the program director reports to somebody and reports to somebody else who finally reports to the president of the organization. Mm-hmm. It has to be front and center and in the DNA of every LGBT organization. It's about everybody out communicating and educating about this. People have to be educated about the harm that they're causing to other people. Mm-hmm. We can't stand up on a table and scream for rights, You'll never hear me say that my adversaries are haters. I mean, maybe Tony Perkins and some of the ringleaders and Franklin Graham, they're perverted haters. But for the most part, the everyday people, the people in the pews, they don't mean harm to other people. And if we don't share with them and explain to them the harm they are causing, they'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to take every LGBT organization to talk about it. It's going to take other fair-minded organizations to talk about it. We've got to get this out on the table and talk about it and get people to understand. And if that happens, I don't think there's a backlash. Mm-hmm. In my own community, we have a gay-straight alliance at the high school. Was there a little backlash from some extreme clergy there? Yes. But they became the minority, and most people in the community saw that it was the fair thing to do to allow kids to gather for a club in high school and have camaraderie and to learn.
Hmm. There are young people in this country who have come of age in reasonably safe surroundings. Maybe their parents were accepting pretty much right away. School friends are accepting. Popular culture is affirming for the most part. But for some of them, it might be that things seem to be going in the opposite direction. What would you say to one of those young people right now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was interviewing somebody for a senior position, and they live in New York, and the first thing he said to me when he sat down was, you know, I just want to thank you for the work that you do, because I have a 13-year-old son who just came out, and he's, you know, getting himself through it. And I said, gosh, in New York City? Mm. And he said, yeah. He said, it's just not as easy as it sounds. And, you know, even there's just the peer pressure, mm-hmm. of not being the same. You know, 50% of the kids were gay. Make it easier. So I think it just takes them a little time. But for sure, parents' total acceptance and embracing, not just accepting and tolerating, but to really embrace their child and let them know that they totally love them exactly the way they are and support them. You know, that's what's so important for a young person. I mean, I had the good fortune of a father who totally embraced me when I came out to him. I'm not sure he would have done it when I was 14, but when I was 26 and came out, I'll always remember, he said to me, Mitchell, all I care about is that you're happy and healthy. I love you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a parent to say that to a kid, it makes all the difference in the world. And when they don't hear that, it also makes all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. That's not what my mother said to me, and that scarred me for a long time.
Mitchell, where are you concentrating your efforts right now and in the months ahead, activism-wise?
Well, I've really putting a lot of energy into the Tyler Clemente Foundation, because I think one way to talk to people is to get them to understand that true faith doesn't bully. And when a minister is on a pulpit and says that homosexuality is a sin, that's bullying. A 13 or 14 or 15-year-old kid in their audience. When a clergy person tells an LGBT person that they need to pray their gay away or need to get a better relationship with God and that they're broken, that's bullying. And when parents tell their child, that a child that comes out that and says they're gay, and they say, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, we can pray together, or let me get you a Christian counselor or something, that's bullying.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of bullying that goes on. It's not just bullying in the schoolyard or bullying in the neighborhood. And the Tyler Clemente Foundation launched a program called True Faith Doesn't Bully. And Justin Lee is a fantastic fellow who's running the project. And I think we're going to hear a lot more from the Tyler Clemente Foundation about it. And a big effort is to get people to sign their Upstander Pledge. You can just Google Tyler Clemente Upstander Pledge and read it and sign it. And that will cause people to really think about when they see a minister standing in church and saying it's a sin and pummeling these people that are in the audience, whether they're 13 years old or 30 years old or 60 years old, to stand up to that minister and say, no, we can't talk like this anymore. We've got to talk about this. Or if a neighbor sees another neighbor who has a gay child and they're not treating that child well, to stand up for that child, to stand up for people. We can't just let other people hurt others.
Mm-hmm. Mitchell Gold is the co-founder and CEO of Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, a global furniture and design brand based in North Carolina. Mitchell is a lifelong activist with a focus on young LGBTQ people and creating space for them to thrive both in secular and religious spaces in this country. In 2012, I was honored to present him with the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, President's Award. Mitchell Gold, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. And I want you to know what's also exciting to me is when I'm in the factory after this airs, we have people who work for us in the factory that listen, and they're going to give me a thumbs up when they see me. Thank you so much for having me, and love to be with you and Judy always.